From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. It is always nice to have you. Thanks for joining us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Let's start the week with something that most of us tend to dread, job negotiations. Whether it's for a promotion or for a raise or for a starting salary, it can be uncomfortable for anyone. But for women of color in particular, it can feel like a mountain to climb. That's because even though men and women tend to ask for raises at roughly the same frequency, men are given raises 20% of the time, women will be given a raise 15% of the time.
So we held a mock job and money negotiation with the woman who holds training seminars for other women. Her name is Rachel Roberts, and she worked with Irene Canyo, a Rochesterian who says she feels anxiety thinking about dealing with these situations. In this clip, you will hear, at first, the mock job negotiation, and then their review of it.
So, Irene, thank you so much for interviewing. We all have enjoyed getting to know you, and we would love to offer you the position.
Awesome. Thank you.
Great. So, to make you an offer, I need to know what you are currently making.
Well, I am interested to know. No, I already messed up. That question throws me off.
You don't have to divulge either your most recent. This
yes.
is a negotiation. So you can, you want to throw a target, a dart at the wall and
yeah.
hit a number. I don't care what you say. It doesn't have to reflect what you recently been paid. This is just kind of walk through.
Let's just say C in the mock negotiation, but I don't think I would want to give my salary. Am I on the right track? But so I'm interested in something in the range of 30 to 35,000 a year.
Great. I don't know that I have a budget for that high of a salary, given what this position is, and you would be the highest paid employee in that category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm happy to explore that further later.
Okay, great. So I'm happy to send you the salary in writing and the benefits for your review. And could I have an answer by the end of this week?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. So that's
what it sounds like.
I mean, in a fictitious scenario, mm-hmm. yes. And sometimes there's more back and forth.
Yeah.
But breaking that down, I saw the look on your face.
And this is a mock negotiation. It's not even real. And you were feeling it, weren't you?
Yes.
And what were you feeling?
I was like, oh, I don't want to give a number.
And your instinct was right.
Right.
I want to first say, you know, when I said we enjoy getting to know you and like to offer you the position, your first response was enthusiasm, mm-hmm. which that's great. And I deliberately threw out that question, I need to know to make you an offer what mm-hmm. you're currently making. That's one of the things that's in different states right now. Massachusetts has passed. That question is illegal, and other states are working towards making that.
How about New York?
It's not passed yet, and it's still legal. Mm. But to
that's a heck of a leverage play.
It is, yeah. Because if you consider the gender wage gap, if women
and
are
the race
already
wage gap.
And the race, yes, absolutely, wage gap. If you consider that those demographics are already paid a lower rate, having to divulge that information will then just continue to exponentially keep that divide going. So your instincts are absolutely right of not wanting to divulge it, but what are those deflection strategies
right.
to use?
Right, I didn't know what to say.
Exactly. And so what I would encourage you to do is attend one of these workshops, take it online. There's mm-hmm. tons of deflection strategies online by saying, well, you know, I'm curious to know how your company values this position and where it falls in the compensation standards that mm-hmm. you have. That could be one way of saying it. Or if they ask about your past salary history, to say, actually, this is a different position than what I had previously applied to. And so I'd like to be compensated equitably for what this position requires of my skills and experience.
Yeah, you know? Those are good. So I kind of just ignored the question and they said something else.
Yeah, exactly. And if they keep pushing, then figure out a response that way.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the second piece. And hopefully when they come up with a number. They will be the one first because the person doing the hiring should have that number in place. They should have a range for what they are looking to achieve and to pay that person. And I was similarly working in nonprofits before, and when still am in a nonprofit, but when I had the responsibility of hiring people, I would talk with them and say, this is the budget that I have. I'm offering you the top of the budget that I have, you know. And another, not everyone operates that way, obviously, but another strategy too, if you are making movement with the salary number or even not at an impasse, to consider is the benefits. What is it that you really value? And it's not just the healthcare, whatever contributions that can mean, but it could be working remotely or having access to professional development funds or having more time off negotiating that. Perhaps you're moving to an organization or a company that starts everybody at the same place, yet you've been at a higher level previously. I think knowing your strategy for how you will approach a negotiation and what works would be important to do. If you go to the salary negotiation workshop, either in person or the one online, there's four steps to how to prepare. And the first is knowing your value. This is separate from a resume that you put together, but how do you value the contributions that you make and what interests you? What are you proud of? And how do you sit and write that down separate from writing a resume, but have that a piece of your value so that you can refer to it all throughout this process? When you negotiate and ask for more, it's a chance to remind that employer or the hiring manager that this is why you hired me. This is what I will bring to the company, and be able to refer to that multiple times in different contexts. The second step of the salary negotiation strategy is doing comparative research. So what are the resources out there to compare what different salaries are? And in your situation, as an independent consultant, so to speak, it's harder because those are not as transparent. In nonprofit, it's harder because every nonprofit has a different pay scale that they have. But there are places to begin to go to. One is salary.com. That is what AAUW recommends. And the importance of going there is because it is employer-reported data, not employee-reported data. So an employer who reports would be able to have all of the information, salary and benefits, to make a more equitable comparison.
Next, here's a powerful clip from a conversation with grad students from the University of Rochester. They're part of the local chapter of a national organization seeking to bring more people of color into STEM fields. That means students and professors.
The students opened up about the pressure they feel when they have to offer presentations. They feel like they're not just representing themselves. They feel like they have to represent their entire race. Here's Shukri Abdul Rashid, and then you'll hear Marion Akun Farmer.
In regards to, you know, microaggressions, it's something that, you know, it's a little bit more subtle. So it's a lot harder to address, and I would say, although these things exist, they become problematic in our own heads, right? So just overthinking and over-evaluating situations can often cause a lot of discomfort and just a lot of additional pressure to perform well, to overperform, right? To prove that you have what it takes to be here, to prove that you're at least equal to your counterparts, right? So in that regard, you know, it's always a persistent challenge to be able to sort of silence these voices that are in your head that are telling you that you're not good enough, you don't have what it takes, you know, and it makes the failures that you experience so much more felt. You know, when you fail, you feel like you've let down your entire race sometimes, and you feel like you've only sort of, you know, validated the stereotypes relating to intellectual inferiority and things along those lines. But I would say, being a minority in science, you know, although there's a lot of psychological sort of difficulties that you encounter, in many ways, you know, you have a lot of advantages in that these programs, they're now looking for, you know, diverse applicants, and they there's a lot of opportunities for people that are minorities in STEM to sort of advance. And there's multiple platforms and organizations that are designed to increase diversity in STEM. So right now is a good time. And as Marion said, there's a lot of work that continues to be done or needs to be done. So that's what ADSE intends to address.
That's pretty heavy. I mean, do you feel like you are constantly having to prove and reprove yourself?
Absolutely. Every day. Whether I give a presentation or even whether it's the way that I hold a 20-second conversation in the elevator, constantly under the gun. So I feel like that's something that's going to continue to persist. And we can definitely address these issues extrinsically as we, you know, try to, you know, increase diversity in STEM. But I recognize that I also have some work to do myself in terms of me being more comfortable in my abilities and know that I'm here because of my credentials and my hard work.
Do you want to add, Marion? I saw Marion sort of, I would say, vigorously agreeing with the idea that you're kind of constantly feeling like you have to prove yourself or prove, you know, your intellectual capabilities.
Yeah, I mean, that is probably one of the hardest parts about being in the field and especially pursuing a PhD and especially wanting to be in a faculty role. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, I don't know if you've heard of the imposter syndrome, and, you know, a lot of students feel that imposter syndrome. And I can't speak for my white colleagues in terms of their level of imposter syndrome, but I know that for mine, it's, you know, the imposter syndrome, what feels like times 10, you know, just from the standpoint of kind of what Shukru was just describing, where I've walked out of presentations and just started crying. You know, and my PI is like, you did a phenomenal job, but it feels as if, and, you know, a lot of this is also my personal, you know, need to be maybe perfect or need to make my parents proud or need to not be that black girl who could have been great and couldn't be great because she just can't do it. You know, this is a bit of a hard one for me.
Oh, I'm sorry, Marion. Sorry. Well, listeners, you're seeing, you know, how heavy this can be.
Finally, along those lines, we had a discussion about a book called Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? The book explores both social dynamics and structural racism. An African-American caller named Rich wanted to share his perspective on what it's like to be the only person of color in a room. Then you'll hear Aqua Porter, vice president of the Board of Trustees at Cuca College and a former corporate executive. Here's Rich.
As a black student, I was always in the advanced classes. Then I went to a Ivy League type school, and we would try to find comfort in each other and commonality because we just didn't have it. I think that the white students were uncomfortable with it because all of a sudden, honestly, I think they saw a larger group of black students together, and there would be 15 or 20 of us. We were talking in our language. We were telling our jokes. We were enjoying each other's company. And you would ask the question, you would get the question, why don't you, you know, why do you sit, you know, by yourselves or anything like that? And this was back in the late 70s, early 80s. We sort of took offense to it. We didn't get angry, but we realized what it was. And we always would joke, you know, they don't like us meeting. Even now, you know, like, honestly, if I see I go amongst people where there's a lot of white people, and sometimes there's a little nod to each other, but there's a stigma with it. We know it exists. So this is part of all of it, you know, the stigma of don't be together, don't gather together. And I even see it in today's world, or maybe I just feel it. I don't know if your guests have dealt with that either.
Yeah, I think it's compelling to really hear these stories. What do you make of Rich's experience?
No, I agree. And Rich, I think, you know, a lot of times you'll say, oh, there's two black kids together. You better not get a group because they'll think we're plotting against them. Right? I mean, it's kind of how, I think a lot of it was how kind of black kids just kind of dealt with it. You know, there was always the underlying tension that we were going to somehow riot or there was going to be, you know, some kind of threat. And so there was always that. I think after a while, you just kind of, you know, let it roll off your shoulders. But I do believe that there was this, you know, underlying thought about how many black kids are going to kind of group together. Then, you know, what will the white kids or faculty or administration think?
And Rich, can I follow? Go ahead, Rich. Yeah.
And then there's this one more thing that this goes all hand in hand. And I started coining this term with my friends. And we, especially as black men, we always have to tap dance. We have to, when we go into a crowd of white people, we have, you know, and I've, since I've always been around them, I've always dealt with this. But you have this thing of, you have to always seek them out and you have to always let them know that you're okay. And it, and you will see, like, if you walk into a room, especially a room where white people don't know you, there's almost this hush and this look. And the first thing I do is I used to always try to make them feel comfortable by talking to someone I knew, by being outwardly friendly, gregarious, i.e. tap dancing. And when you don't have to do that, that's nice too. So that's another reason that you want to be able to get together. And you want to be able to relax and just be yourself. There's this constant need to reassure. It gets tiring.
It does get tiring. I agree. I mean, I think, you know, ask yourself a question. And I don't think that you, probably very few white people have had the reverse experience where you've gone into a place where you're the only. If you've gone into a black church or if you've got, like, you're the only one there, or you go to an organization that's filled, I don't care if it's with people, you know, people that are similar to you, but they're all black. If you go to some kind of gala or event where you're the only white person, or you're one of you and your wife, or you and your husband are the only, you know, white people that are there, you know, how do you feel? Do you feel different? Do you feel like, do I really fit in? I mean, imagine that being your everyday existence. Every day you're wondering, you know, whether you fit in, whether you're good enough, whether you measure up, how you're being looked at, how you're being measured. It's a very tiring, exhausting way to live. And I think that going and finding a group of people who are like you, who have that shared experience, whether it's at lunch or whether it's, you know, in your little corner of the college or workplace, is the place where you go for respite.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, on WRUR 88.5 FM, and if you're in the Finger Lakes, on WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone, and we will talk to you Monday.